Now that the Congressional Super Committee has failed to agree on a plan to trim the deficit, it's worth stepping back and asking this fundamental question. How much trouble are we in, anyway? Well, Planet Money's Alex Bloomberg says when it comes to an answer, it's actually not hard to find agreement between the left and the right.
First of all, everyone agrees on the basic fact. Our nation is pretty deep in debt. It owes about $10 trillion.
That's about 70% of our economy. Historically, that number has been a little bit under 40% since the end of World War II.
This is Allison Fraser from the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank. And she would disagree with policy experts on the left on a bunch of issues having to do with that number. For example, what should the number be? She would like to get it down to 40 or 30% of GDP. People on the left would be happy with trimming that number a bit, or just keeping it steady where it is at 70. Fraser would like to get that number down mainly through spending cuts. People on the left would add raising taxes and closing loopholes to the mix. But this is not a story about how the left and right disagree with each other. In fact, it's a story about how long-term, big picture, they largely agree. They agree that within a decade or two, if nothing is done, debt is going to be a much bigger problem for our country than it is today. First, let's hear from the right-leaning Allison Fraser and then Bob Greenstein from the left-leaning Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
We are on the wave of the leading edge of 78 million baby boomers retiring into entitlement programs. So going forward, spending in the future is unsustainable.
Over the course of a few decades, the debt would rise to over 100% and then over 200% of GDP and keep rising. That's not sustainable.
You know, it starts with Social Security, then it spreads to Medicare. And the simple fact is, wonks like me on the right, center, and left all agree that these are the programs that need to be cracked.
The two factors are A, the aging of the population, B, the increase in health care costs throughout the entire U.S. health care system. Those two factors are what drive the projected rate of growth in Medicare and Medicaid, and to a much lesser degree, in Social Security.
In other words, over the next few decades, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid will consume a bigger and bigger share of government spending. And if something isn't done, these programs could eventually bankrupt us. Another thing these two agree about, as things stand right now, our debt is scheduled to grow faster than our economy as a whole will grow. So it's like when you have a credit card balance that increases month after month. Our debt is growing year after year.
Over the course of the coming decade, we do need to get to the point where the debt isn't rising faster than the economy. Now, if you do enough to get you there in the coming decade, that will not be enough to keep you there in future decades without larger reforms in the healthcare system.
Right. So it's we do the hard work of getting to that point, and then we've got even harder work ahead, which is basically
precisely
reforming our healthcare system.
That's exactly right. We have hard work in the coming decade, but it will then get even harder. That's exactly right.
And this frames the failure of the supercommittee in an especially harsh light. By most accounts, just to get to that first step, stabilizing the growth of the debt, the step before the hard step of figuring out what to do about Medicare, by all accounts, that first step would involve coming up with $4 trillion in deficit reduction over the next 10 years, a $4 trillion combination of spending cuts and tax increases. The supercommittee was discussing a number half to a third that size. In other words, a number that wouldn't have even stopped the debt from growing, a number much smaller than it needed to be. And they couldn't even agree on that. For NPR News, I'm Alex Bloomberg.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, offering IRA savings products and a Raise Your Rate four-year CD. Learn more at allybank.com.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. A few months ago, listeners to the NPR program Tell Me More heard this self-styled, eccentric crime fighter from Seattle who calls himself Phoenix Jones.
I've been stabbed once. I've had my nose broken. I recently got punched with a key. I've been hit with a baseball bat. I've been held at gunpoint. And you know what happened during all those incidences? The citizen who didn't come out there wearing a bulletproof vest and wearing armor didn't get hurt. So if I have to take a little bit of punishment to make sure that my citizens don't get hurt, I guess I have to.
Phoenix Jones is a pseudonym. He and others like him are the subjects of John Ronson's The Amazing Adventures of Phoenix Jones. After reading about them, I still can only barely believe them, probably because John Ronson specializes in nonfiction that strains credulity. He wrote Men Who Stare at Goats about the Pentagon's efforts at extrasensory warfare, and he joins us from London to talk about Phoenix Jones, Mr. Extreme, Urban Avenger, and others. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's nice to be here again.
And what is a real-life superhero?
Okay, there's hundreds of them all across America, and they come from all walks of life, and they dress up in super suits and go off in the dead of night fighting crime. And they've been going for quite a long time without too much fanfare.
Phoenix Jones, which is not his real name, and in your e-book, we learn what his real name is at the end, he goes out into the streets dressed up as if he were some cross between Batman or some other crime-fighting superhero.
Yeah, it's a black and gold outfit, bulletproof vest, which was handy because we ended up confronting some crack dealers in Belltown, Seattle at 4 o'clock in the morning. So his bulletproof vest was presumably a good idea.
Are these people really courageous, or for that matter, skilled crime fighters?
Most of them aren't. Most of them actually don't try to be. Most of them will go off and be happy to just hand out sandwiches to the homeless, do little acts of philanthropy. There's only a few groups that will actually get into genuinely dangerous, life-threatening situations. And one is a group of New Yorkers called the New York Initiative. And then you've got Phoenix's gang in Seattle, who will leap into genuinely frightening situations. The first time I met Phoenix, it was about 5 o'clock in the morning. I'd just got off the plane and I was expecting to go back to the hotel and get some sleep. But instead, I had to go straight to the emergency room where he'd been rushed there because he'd been beaten up too many times in just 2 weeks. And the first time I saw him, he was strapped to IVs, still wearing his super mask, because at that point, nobody had ever seen his secret identity.
Has he ever actually thwarted a crime?
Yeah, I think he thwarts crimes frequently. There's a couple of problems. One is that if he's on his way to thwart a crime and somebody recognises him from YouTube, he'll quite often stop and have his picture taken, and by which time the crime has vanished. I was with him at 4 a.m. in Belltown on one occasion where he refused to leave the corner where a bunch of crack dealers were standing, even though they were saying, if you don't leave, we're going to kill you. And Phoenix was saying, do we stand or do we leave? We stand. And these guys were walking towards Phoenix, and it was a moment of kind of incredible bravery.
Yes, you were not sharing in this brave confidence at that.
No, in fact, there was this verbal confrontation just beforehand where the crack dealers were saying, you know, you can't come here in your stupid outfits. So, yeah, this is real life to us. This is, you know, this isn't fun and games. This is real life. And I found myself nodding ostentatiously with everything the crack dealers were saying, just in case the shooting started. I thought maybe they'd remember my nodding and, you know, think to shoot around me. But Phoenix and his gang were. And sure enough, the crack dealer said to them, you're so stupid to be standing here. You know, people die here. We could kill you now. But I guess if you're not going to leave, we're just going to have to go home.
Typically, what do the police make of these real-life superheroes? They look at people who are helping them, or as loony pains in the neck? What do they say?
I see them as loony pains in the neck. They really don't like Phoenix. They see him as a liability. There's a bit of a war going on, really, between Phoenix and the police. You know, Phoenix will say, you know, when you're patrolling Seattle at 2 a.m. and you see people getting beaten up, Phoenix will say, well, I'm going to break this up because we're the police. As he rushes in, he will try and get somebody to phone 911. So he doesn't want to take the place of the police, but the police see him as just an annoyance.
Well, John Ronson, thanks a lot for talking with us about your e-book, e-article. What's the genre here?
I guess a sort of mini book.
Mini book. It's called The Amazing Adventures of Phoenix Jones. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Robert.
Now we turn to an issue that many high school seniors and their parents will be spending their holidays fretting over: college admissions. It can be a daunting process getting all those essays, recommendations, and financial aid forms ready in time for December and January deadlines. And getting into college can be especially tough for students who are the first in their families to walk that path. We wanted to spend some time talking about how parents and teens can navigate the complicated college admissions process. So we have called on an expert to help us out. Joy St. John is the director of admissions at Wellesley College, a liberal arts college outside of Boston. Joy, nice to have you.
Thank you for having me, Tony.
There are so many areas to approach. Let's begin with this one, because you were already reading some early decision applications, and I understand that the most common questions that you are getting from parents and students right now about money, which is a no-brainer, I would think. What is your advice for helping families figure out what they can and cannot afford?
Well, yes, certainly. Over the last several years, families have been increasingly concerned about cost and their ability to finance a college education for their child. And we very much focus on talking to parents about looking at real costs versus the sticker price. So sometimes what can happen with families is that they can focus just on, well, what is the published tuition cost to attend an institution, not thinking about the full cost of attendance and financial aid options that are available to them. So a great example is at a school like Wellesley, our total cost of attendance is about $54,000 when you include not just tuition, but also books and expenses. But if you look at the students who are enrolled at Wellesley, about 58% of those students are receiving financial aid, and the average grant or scholarship portion of those financial aid awards is over $36,000. So although our cost is high, because we are able to offer generous need-based financial aid, our real cost to families can often be lower than they expect.
You mentioned student loans. I want to get to that some more with you. We're talking with Joy St. John, Director of Admissions at Wellesley College. You mentioned, as I said, student loan. There are a lot of issues with that. So how do you figure out what is safe and what is affordable with regard to student loans?
Well, the way that student loans are packaged in financial aid awards very much differs from institution to institution. So at a place like Wellesley, we've really been conscious about keeping our loan costs, our loan levels low for students, and managing student indebtedness in a way that we think serves students well. And so we've done things, for instance, like eliminate the student loan component of a financial aid award for students from families with incomes of $60,000 or less. And we've also created a cap on the maximum loan amount that could be packaged for an individual student, so that no student should graduate with more than with any more than about $12,800 in student loan debt. But it very much differs from institution to institution.
Let me stop you there. Mm-hmm. You said no one should graduate with more than $12,000 in student loan debt. Is that correct?
It's about 12. This is from Wellesley.
From Wellesley.
So at about $12,800, so about $3,200 per year. So this very much differs from the national average, where students on average are graduating with debt of over about $25,000.
Right. That was why I was going to ask you that, because how realistic that is for students going to most university, state or private, these days.
Right. Well, so I'm just using that as an example to explain why it's really important for families to do research, mm-hmm. to figure out what the loan policies are for the institutions that they're considering. So a great way to do that, most colleges now have a financial aid calculator on their websites, and actually, it's a federal requirement for colleges and universities administering federal aid funds. So families can go to college websites and take the family's W-2 and tax return information and input it into these calculators. And the calculators will not only help families figure out how much aid they might qualify for at that institution, but it will also help families figure out, you know, if they're eligible for $20,000 worth of need-based financial aid, let's say. It will also break down for them how that aid will be awarded. So how much student loan would be in that aid award. And there are limitations to these calculators. They are just estimates. They're only as good and accurate as the information the families put into them. And they only really demonstrate first-year aid. So for schools that perhaps change their loan amounts from after the first year, there may be some differences, but it's at least a good starting point.
To get information
Absolutely. About schools' loan policies. And it would be great if, you know, if there was some across-the-board policy that was very easy to understand, but different institutions have different resources for financial aid, and they decide to use those resources in different ways. So a calculator is a way to get the specific information.
If you're just joining us, let me just let the audience know who and what we're doing. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Tony Cox, sitting in for Michelle Martin, and we are talking about how parents and students can navigate the college admissions process. And we are speaking with Joy St. John, the director of admissions at Wellesley College. Joy, I want to come back for a second off of the issue of finances, which obviously is a very important one, perhaps the most important one. But you got to get into the school first. And let's talk about that process for a moment in terms of applying to schools. What is the most important thing that people should know about what should or should not go into your application?
Well, I think most students would benefit from understanding that you need to take care and attention to think about how all of the pieces of your application sort of reflect upon you. So obviously, one of the things that matters most is really something that in some ways is already a done deal by the time you're applying to college, and that's your high school transcript, right? So the courses that you've selected and the grades that you've received in those courses. But then there are also pieces of the application that you have some influence over. Your essay is one, and even to some extent, your letters of recommendation. And so those are the things that students, I think, need to pay particular care and attention and in creating and submitting. So and a great example is in the personal essay is to think about, you know, what is the question that the school is asking you to answer and what information are you trying to convey? And sometimes students get wrapped up in maybe being very literal about interpreting the essay question. So the essay question may be describe a person who has had a significant influence on you and describe that influence on you. And they may have to answer that question in 500 words. So it's very easy for a student to get focused on the person who's of significance to them and not focus on how that person has influenced who they are.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, our time is running short, and there are many, many questions, as I said, I had for you. Here's one, and I'd like for you, if you can, to answer it as briefly as possible. What happens if you're the first timer and you don't have anybody in your family or in your immediate circle to turn to? Where do you go for advice, really quickly?
I really think that students should look often for community-based organizations that provide some college guidance and college counseling. And there are sometimes resources within a school. If a school doesn't have a very strong college counseling program, there are often teachers who teach more advanced courses who may be of assistance to students as they're trying to sort of navigate all of these pieces of the process.
That helps very much. And I'm sure you would agree that you have to make your deadlines as well.
And you have to make your deadline.
Joy St. John is the director of admissions at Wellesley College, and she joined us from a studio on that campus. Joy, thank you very much. It was helpful.
You're welcome.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We're about to embark on a covert culinary mission. Washington, D.C., 8 a.m. An NPR team seeking information slips into a local restaurant. They continue through the dining area, through a set of double doors, and into the kitchen for a prearranged meeting with a man wearing an apron and a bow tie. His code name is Chris Kimball. That's because of his resemblance to the host of the public television program America's Test Kitchen. Our team for this mission includes a person who, at least according to the official logs, is off today. Morning Edition's Renee Montaigne.
I've left my Thanksgiving preparations to come here and join the two of you here at the restaurant Zola here in Washington, D.C. But why, Chris, did you have us come here?
Because we're just a few feet away from the International Spy Museum. And today we are actually doing some recipes that have some secret techniques and secret ingredients.
Secret ingredients, like I'm going to like fire the turkey out of a cannon in the front of the James Bond car or something like that.
I'd love to see that.
We will not see that. But as with all covert operations, the key is precisely what you don't see. In this dimly lit space, far from any window, we're quietly preparing a turkey. Chris Kimball, the man with the bow tie, plans to add something to that traditional dish.
A lot of people want something a little bit new, so they decide to do an herb-roasted turkey. So what they do is slather some herbs, a paste on the skin, or maybe they shove some herbs in the cavity. If you just put herbs in the cavity, there's no flavor. And the herbs on the skin get dried out and get sort of bitter, so we have to figure out a secret way to solve the problem.
Decades ago, during the Cold War, a notorious spy case turned on papers supposedly hidden in a pumpkin. We're not sure, but maybe this inspired Chris Kimball's idea to hide that bright green mixture of parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme inside the turkey.
But the real secret was we actually take the breast, and I have a paring knife, and I'm going to make an incision, as a doctor would, into the breast, about an inch and a half, like this, and I'm putting the paste inside the middle of the breast.
It's like you're creating a secret chamber here.
A secret chamber.
This is the equivalent of hiding a document in the secret chamber inside the heel of your shoe.
And just as you steam an envelope to open it undetected, you will not find the true meaning of the secret herbs unless you apply some heat. Roast the turkey for 45 minutes, upside down, then flip it, then wait.
Let's talk about stuffing next, because stuffing seems to be a food that's a natural for something secret in there.
I have a stuffing with a very secret ingredient, cornflakes.
No, wait, I just have to back you up.
Look, this just shows how far you can go in the kitchen to do something interesting. It can be the base for stuffing. And so we saute a bunch of onions, some celery. We take a box of cornflakes.
And that's a big box.
This is a large box.
That's an economy size.
Yeah. Well, this is Thanksgiving.
Now, it would seem the obvious advantage here is that the cornflakes are crispy. But from what I know of cornflakes, they get soggy very fast.
Well, all stuffing gets soggy very fast because you're cooking in a bird for 2 or 3 hours. So it almost doesn't matter what you put in the bird because the bird itself is flavoring the stuffing. We have a few eggs that have been beaten up here. We'll add those. We have some chicken stock.
You know, this moment with the chicken stock being poured over the cornflakes
is just
it's too
much for you.
Do you mind if I just step back?
You can't take breakfast and dinner together. Now it's starting to look a little bit better because we have the chicken stock with the onions. We have a little green from the parsley. Renee's getting a little closer to the bowl now. You've stepped in.
Yeah, it's turned to fascination. Horror has turned to fascination.
You can put some of the stuffing inside the turkey. The rest you can bake in a foil-covered pan for about 30 minutes. When you're done, your secret will be hidden in plain sight.
Oh, it's still crunchy in places. This is awesome. You can still taste the cornflakes in there, in a good way.
If I were to ask you at dinner what this delicious stuffing was, what was in it, Chris? Come on, tell me. How did you make it? What would you say?
I'd lie. Of course.
Of course he'd lie. In wartime, as Churchill once said, truth must be protected by a bodyguard of lies. But we have to be brutally honest about the next dish, green beans.
I think green beans are, they're called the massacre dish. It's one of those things you think are easy, therefore you don't spend much time thinking about it, and they always end up awful.
Chris Kimball aims for better beans with a secret ingredient, something that James Bond would expect to find in his well-shaken martini, vermouth.
Now, this is something that Julia Child, I know, always had on hand, and it's a great way to add a little flavor to a dish at the last minute. It's also more concentrated, and of course, as Julia knew well, it has higher alcohol content. There's nothing wrong with that, so we'll add a little bit of, just a couple tablespoons of vermouth at the end, and nobody will know what it is. It's a lot more interesting than your basic boiled beans with the shallots and the vermouth.
So if you're one of those people that really doesn't enjoy Thanksgiving and hanging out with the family at Thanksgiving, I mean, if you eat enough of these green beans, will it kind of ease the pain a little bit?
If you have relatives you really don't like, eat the beans.
No, or they're delicious.
No, you're definitely not getting drunk on this. Okay. I'm sorry.
Really tasty.
Now I spy the end of the meal. Not pumpkin pie. Kimball suggests spiced pumpkin cheesecake. It requires a secret technique for preparing the canned pumpkin filling.
The problem is it has a lot of moisture in it, and you don't want that extra moisture in the cheesecake. because you want the texture of the cheesecake to be just right. That extra water really ruins it. So we've lined the bottom of the baking sheet with a triple layer of paper towels.
Okay.
We then have the pumpkin filling, and we're going to, as if we were 5 years old,
spread it out everywhere.
Spread it. This is a great thing for kids. Yes, they can make a big mess and spread it out.
On the paper towels.
On the paper towels.
Take three more paper towels and place them on top of the pumpkin filling.
So now we've pressed it down.
May I say, it looks different. The pumpkin looks visibly different because
drier.
Of so much, so much less water.
It does. One thing you should remember is that, and I've done this a million times, when you go to make cheesecake, you got to remember to take the cream cheese out of the refrigerator ahead of time. Because if it's cold and you put it in a standing mixer or the electric hand mixer, it's just not going to mix properly. You got to take it out at least an hour ahead of time, preferably two. And that's a little secret.
One more.
Then you'll drop that pumpkin into a blender where you've already been mixing cream cheese. Gradually add eggs, cinnamon, ginger, nutmeg, cloves, and heavy cream.
So there we have it.
Pour it in.
Pour it into the springform pan. We pre-baked the bottom crust.
So those little lumps don't matter. No. They'll just melt down.
Thank you, Renee, for mentioning that. Yes. No, the little lumps are fine. Okay. I took a taste even though they're raw eggs.
You don't
eggs.
Mind raw eggs?
Yeah, so.
Sure, sure. We can all get some
together.
Hosts of Morning Edition killed in food segment.
And as it goes in the oven, you may not even see on the bottom of the cheesecake, hidden from view, a graham cracker crust.
Boy, that's the quickest cooking job of cheesecake I've ever seen. Mmm. Oh, this is really delicious.
Mind if I scrape some crust off the bottom of the pan here?
No, go right ahead. Mm. Thanksgiving.
Mmm.
Do anything I want.
Wow.
Chris, Steve, you know, I'm actually sorry since this is so delicious, but I have to run right now. I'm going to leave you with the rest of the show, Steve. Got to run out and make my own dinner for my own family.
And Chris Kimball, thank you for coming by once again this Thanksgiving.
A pleasure. Happy to feed you.
Good to meet you here next to the International Spy Museum and get a few secret ingredients, which you can find, they're not so secret anymore, at npr.org. Chris Kimball is the host of America's Test Kitchen and the editor and publisher of Cook's Illustrated Magazine.
There's a competition underway in sports venues around the country, and it has nothing to do with how many points or runs are scored. As NPR's Ben Bergman reports from Los Angeles, it is a technology race to see which stadium or arena can be the most connected.
The Staples Center hosts some 250 events a year. It's home to two NBA teams, when they're not locked out, countless concerts, and, on a recent night, NHL hockey.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, get on your feet and greet your Los Angeles game!
The game is a sellout, and fans donning black, white, and purple Kings jerseys aren't shy about sharing their devotion to their beloved team.
Let's go, Kings! Let's go, Kings!
One person here is dressed in a suit, not a hockey jersey, and he doesn't really care who wins or loses. He's David Holland, who runs the sports and entertainment division of tech giant Cisco, which has been doing a brisk business lately upgrading stadiums around the world.
The venue operators recognize if they don't find a way to elevate the experience in the venue that ultimately they'll lose to the couch.
So stadiums have to stay one step ahead.
I'm in my early 50s, and for me, I can go to a ball game and just sit there and watch a live event. But for the next generation fan, they really expect to have more of an integrated experience watching a live event, but being able to surf the internet or access social networking aspects that they engage in throughout their day.
That means fast Wi-Fi and HDTV, technology that equals rather than surpasses what you find in many updated homes. More impressive is what Holland shows off in the luxury suites. You get to play TV director with the press of a few buttons.
You could actually tailor the environment you're in and have different angles of in-house camera feeds, for example. So you could be watching from behind the net, from the corner where the boards are, but you can tailor it yourself.
Staples is just the latest upgraded facility, joining the likes of Sun Life Stadium in Miami and O2 Arena in London, trying to chase sparkling new shrines to sports such as Cowboy Stadium and Yankee Stadium. AEG, the company that owns Staples, won't say how much it paid for the upgrade, but Vice President Todd Klein says the cost was worth it.
We need to compete. We're competing for fans. We're competing for share of wallet to get people through our doors to experience live content in an arena versus at home.
And what about those fans who do still trek to the arena, who endure the traffic, the $25 parking, the $10 beer, the $100 tickets? Why do they keep coming back?
Nothing beats this. I mean, where we sit, you can't see the same game you see on TV, but I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Matt Johnston, standing in line for beer, has been a Kings season ticket holder for years. He loves the team. The new technology, not so much.
I guess I'm all for the future, but I don't know. I'm pretty overwhelmed as it is.
Chow Liu, standing in another line for concessions, is more excited, especially when she hears what the rewiring of Staples will allow. Customizable instant replays on your smartphone.
I'm a huge sports fan, so that's awesome. That's like every sports person's dream, to have every replay on your phone, on your laptop, everything, like everywhere.
Unfortunately, that dream will have to wait a bit longer while the kinks are worked out. So will another feature executives hope to roll out soon, ordering food and drinks from your smartphone so you can skip standing in line altogether. Ben Bergman, NPR News, Los Angeles.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.